Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and Lucy Turnbull, Frank Lowy, Chairman of the Lowy Institute for International Policy and board members of the Institute, Your Excellency General David Hurley, Governor of New South Wales, and Glenn Stevens, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, ministers, ambassadors and consuls general, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening and welcome to the 2016 Lowy Lecture. I'm Michael Fullilove, Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. This is the most important event in the Institute's calendar, and we're delighted that you could join us for it on a day when all of us have been reminded of the vulnerability, as well as the character and the resilience of societies like our own. Before we proceed further, I'd like to invite the founder of the Lowy Institute, Mr. Frank Lowy AC, to the podium to make a few remarks. In this room, and indeed in this country, Frank Lowy needs no introduction. He's the chairman of Westfield and Centre Group, the immediate past chairman of the Football Federation of Australia, and most importantly for me, he's the chairman of the Lowy Institute. Everything we have achieved at Bligh Street has flowed from Frank, not just from his generosity, but his knowledge of the world, his instincts, his contacts, and his remarkable attention to detail. Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Lowy.
Thank you, Michael. Welcome, everybody. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the support and solidarity the Prime Minister expressed this morning for the people of Belgium. We are honoured that the Belgian Ambassador to Australia, His Excellency Mr. Jean-Luc Botson, is able to be with us tonight at what is obviously a very difficult time. Ambassador, you are surrounded by... Ambassador, you are surrounded by firm friends tonight, and our thoughts and prayers are with you and your countrymen and women. Ladies and gentlemen, when I founded the Institute 13 years ago, it was difficult to make sense of the world. The tragic events in Belgium remind us yet again that it has only grown more complex since then. My motivation in founding the Institute was to help us better understand the world, to find solutions to its problems, and find ways for Australia to play a bigger role in the world. That's why I am pleased that the Australian Prime Minister has agreed to deliver the 2016 Lowy Lecture. I have known Malcolm for a long time, as a successful businessman and more recently as a politician. He is also my local member. I have enormous respect for his intellect, his drive, and his belief in public service. He's a leader with big ideas about the future of Australia and our place in the world, and we look forward to listening to him tonight. Thank you, Malcolm, for being here. I'd like now to ask Michael back to the podium to formally introduce the Prime Minister. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, in January 1941, in a little-known speech, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill said, "We stand, all of us, upon the watchtowers of history." And now, as then, the view from the watchtower is sometimes disquieting. There is lots of sunshine, but there are also lots of clouds. The disposition of forces in the world is changing before us. The old order is giving way to something new. The country around which the post-war order was constructed, the United States, has inched back from the world, while powers such as China have stepped forward into it. The pillars supporting that order sometimes feel weak, and the principles that define it are under challenge. In recent months, that challenge has taken the ugly form of attacks on Paris, Istanbul, Ankara, Beirut, Jakarta, San Bernardino, Copenhagen, Ottawa, as well as cities across North Africa and the Middle East. And that challenge was renewed last night in Brussels. Of course, compared to the brittleness of Europe and the bleakness of the Middle East, prospects in Asia are bright. After all, wealth and power are shifting eastwards towards us. For a country like Australia, with an economy that is so interconnected with Asia's economies, this is exhilarating. It holds out tremendous opportunities for us. But our new economic opportunities come with new political risks. We are closer to the world's booming markets and closer to the world's developing crises. We are less isolated and less insulated. For many years, Australians complained about the tyranny of distance, but now the tyranny of distance has been replaced by the predicament of proximity. There is no one better placed to discuss this predicament, both its challenges and its opportunities, than the Australian Prime Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, this lecture is the Lowy Institute's signature event at which a prominent individual reflects on Australia's role in the world and the world's influence on Australia. Past Lowy lecturers have included Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, General David Petraeus, former Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Rupert Murdoch, Executive Chairman of News Corp, and Prime Minister John Howard, who delivered the inaugural Lowy Lecture in 2005 and who is with us tonight. And more than a decade later, we're delighted to welcome Mr. Howard's successor to this podium. I'm very pleased indeed to introduce the 2016 Lowy Lecturer, the Prime Minister of Australia, the Honourable Malcolm Turnbull, MP. Mr. Turnbull has had a remarkable career, in fact several careers, as a Rhodes Scholar, a journalist, lawyer, banker, businessman and chairman of the Australian Republican Movement. He was elected to federal parliament as the member for Wentworth in 2004, and he served in a number of senior offices, including as the Minister for Communications, the Minister for Environment and Water Resources, and the Leader of the Opposition. And in September last year, he was elected as the Leader of the Liberal Party and the Prime Minister of Australia. Malcolm Turnbull is a politician with great ambitions for Australia, and we are delighted that he has chosen to give his first major foreign policy speech in Australia as Prime Minister to the Lowy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Prime Minister to the podium.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It is very honoured to be here tonight to deliver this Lowy Lecture and in the presence of my good friend, mentor, former leader, and of course the deliverer of the first Lowy Lecture, John Howard. It's wonderful to be here with John. And Frank, you and you, Shirley, and your family, what an extraordinary contribution you've made to Australia. In every respect, you personify the ideal active citizen, engaged in every aspect of your life, in business, in philanthropy, in sport, in public affairs. You're a true leader, incurably curious about the world, and you have a very old school attitude to public service. You don't just write out a check, you get involved, boots and all. And you're a dreamer, you're a big thinker, you've got big visions for Australia. Whenever we talk, it's about big things, about infrastructure and big investments, and you had a great piece in the Financial Review about those ideas only the other day, and I have to say that I often find that we are very much of the same mind. So you're an inspiration. And of course the Lowy Institute, in little more than a decade, has become Australia's unquestioned leading think tank on international affairs. It's deepened the debate in Australia about the world, and it's given us a greater voice internationally. It would be very difficult to imagine the foreign policy landscape in Australia today without the Lowy Institute. It's a remarkable achievement. Now, Frank, you asked us to stand for a minute's silence in solidarity with the people of Belgium and showing our love and our condolences for those for the victims of the shocking attacks in Brussels. The Belgian ambassador, Jean-Luc Bodson, is here with us today, and I say to you, Ambassador, that we are all united. with Belgium in this battle against terror, just as our forebears were 100 years ago on the fields of Flanders in the First World War. We are in the same struggle, and we stand with you shoulder to shoulder. Sympathy, love, condolences, but unflinching solidarity in the face of this global threat. We are with you. Ladies and gentlemen, the terrorist attacks in Brussels remind us once again of the global threat of terrorism, the need to be vigilant at home, to maintain the security of our borders, to ensure our laws provide our security forces with the tools they need to keep us safe, and of course to continue to support our allies in the battle against the terrorists of ISIL in Syria and Iraq. The attacks in Brussels are an unfortunate reminder of how violent Islamist extremism appears to have reached a crisis point in Europe. European governments are confronted by a perfect storm of failed or neglected integration, foreign fighters returning from Iraq and Syria, porous borders and intelligence and security apparatus struggling to keep pace with the scope and breadth of the threat. Bernard Squarcini, a former head of France's internal intelligence service, described these factors as creating a favourable ecosystem for an Islamist milieu. For all intents and purposes, there are no internal borders in Europe. That has been a great achievement of openness, and the external borders are difficult to manage. Recent intelligence indicates that ISIL is using the refugee crisis to send operatives into Europe. But this scourge of terrorism is not only a European problem. It is global. Whether it is Brussels or Paris, Ankara or Istanbul, Beirut, Bamako, San Bernardino, Jakarta or Sydney, the world is so connected. Australians and Australia's interests are so widespread that everywhere today is close to home. Al-Qaeda's core strategy was to undertake high-profile, well-planned mass casualty attacks against Western targets, such as the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11. ISIL's brand of terrorism uses different tactics. It promotes opportunistic, relatively unsophisticated random killings, which can be amplified online, such as the use of automatic weapons on a tourist beach in Tunisia or in downtown San Bernardino. ISIL is intent on demonstrating a growing operational reach. And this, we believe, is because it is hurting in Syria and Iraq, losing 22% of its total territory and 40% of its revenues from its peak in 2014. The early signs show that, like the Paris attacks only 4 months ago, the bombings in Brussels were inspired, if not planned, by ISIL in its Syrian headquarters at Al-Raqqa. This underscores the importance of our military contribution against ISIL in Syria and Iraq, in which we have been the second largest contributor to the coalition effort. ISIL's ability to inspire, let alone direct, terrorism around the world will be largely eliminated if its so-called caliphate is decisively defeated in the field. Its defeat requires military force and a political settlement, and we are working with our allies to deliver both. Now, no government can guarantee the absolute absence of terrorism. The terror threat level here in Australia has been at probable since September 2014. Australia, however, is better placed than many of our European counterparts in dealing with the threat of terrorism because of the strength of our intelligence and security agencies, our secure borders, and our successful multicultural society, one that manages to be both secure and free. It is also why the government has reformed our national security legislation to ensure our agencies have the powers they need to mitigate the threat of terror. Our allies regard our national security laws as among the world's best. The advantage of our island geography, our effective border protection, and counter-terrorism agencies mean we have confidence that we know who is arriving. Strong borders, vigilant security agencies governed by the rule of law, and a steadfast commitment to the shared values of freedom and mutual respect. These are the ingredients of multicultural success, which is what we have achieved in Australia. In the fight against terrorism, we are fully committed to playing a leading role in finding the solutions to end ISIL in the Middle East, working with our counterparts in the region, in particular Indonesia and our other ASEAN partners, and continuing to remain vigilant at home. However, we must remember to take care not to view our strategic circumstances solely through the prism of counter-terrorism. Terrorism is an example of the propaganda of the deed. It is designed to frighten and intimidate. It is designed to deter us from our normal way of life. That is why President Widodo was determined to ensure that Jakarta was back to normal within 4 hours of the terrorist bombing in that city in February, and why Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel is determined to return Brussels to business as soon as possible. Terrorism is also designed to make us turn on each other. That is why my government works hard to promote inclusion and mutual respect, ensuring that all communities and all faiths feel part of ours, the most successful multicultural society in the world. I have a deep and personal appreciation of Indonesian President Joko Widodo's commitment to promoting a tolerant and inclusive Islam. He says again and again, Indonesia is proof that democracy, tolerance, moderation, and Islam are compatible. And his powerful rejection of extremism resonates well beyond Indonesia. Australia has a vital interest in seeing President Widodo's commitment to tolerance succeed, as my own discussions with local Muslim leaders have made clear to me. Indeed, the executive director of the Islamic Council of Victoria, Niall Akan, wrote to me to say that the mere fact of my mentioning President Widodo's example has helped in combating extremism and promoting better, more tolerant and mainstream understandings of Islam and the Muslim world. This principle of mutual respect is fundamental to our relationships with our near neighbours, as indeed it is critical in our efforts to counter violent extremism in whatever form it takes in our own society. Now, tonight I could talk at length about many aspects of Australia's engagement with the world, but I want to turn the spotlight closer to home. Fraught as such projections are, I'll sketch what the next wave of growth in Asia might look like and why it promises to be every bit as spectacular as the one that we've experienced. While the Northeast Asian juggernaut may be slowing comparatively, the rest of the Indo-Pacific is only getting started. Villages are being transformed into cities right across the Indian subcontinent, in Indonesia, and in the rest of Southeast Asia. Their citizens are connected to the global marketplace and to each other like never before. It is here, in our Asian region, that the opportunities are most abundant. It is here, in this increasingly crowded strategic space, that the need for consistent, constructive, and creative Australian engagement is greater than ever before. But if we are to make the most of these exciting new opportunities in Asia, we first need to ensure we are resilient and agile at home. We need to make sure our industry, our services, our human capital are best positioned to compete in these dynamic markets. Our economy is successfully transitioning from the mining construction boom to a new and more diverse one, fueled by innovation, the opening of new markets, and more investment in Australian enterprise. We've called it an ideas boom because it is founded in innovation. And unlike any other boom, it can last forever, it can last for as long as our imagination and spirit of enterprise can last. And I believe that I know Australians and the Australian character to know that those qualities will always be enduring in our people. My government's economic plan is supporting this transition to drive economic growth and create new and higher paying jobs in the future, with a new innovation and science agenda that incentivises investment in start-up companies, brings more great Australian ideas to market, ensures more of our research is commercialised here in Australia, and ensures our kids learn the digital skills of the 21st century. Our defence industry plan, part of the Defence White Paper, managed so capably by our Defence Minister, Senator Maurice Payne, who is here tonight. This is investing an additional $1.6 billion alone as part of a huge program in supporting local advanced manufacturing and high technology jobs in innovative industries. The Defence White Paper is a plan for ensuring our Defence Forces have the capabilities, the physical capabilities they need to secure us in the 21st century. But it will also serve to ensure that as far as possible, every dollar that can be spent in Australia, in Australian industries, in Australian advanced manufacturing, in Australian innovation and technology will be spent here. Because we will make, through this plan, Australia more secure, not just in a conventional military sense, but by building up that technology and industry base upon which our economy and hence our security depends. We are reforming our competition laws to promote greater protection for and encouragement for small and medium businesses. As you will have seen today, we are retaining the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Renewable Energy Authority, but with an amended mandate. So they'll be investing in Australian clean energy innovation and technology. As I said in Paris at COP21, that is the key to ensuring we can successfully combat climate change. Technology, innovation, science. We are driving our investment in that regard. And important institutions are not left unaddressed. As you may have noticed, if you've glanced at the news recently, we've effected some important reforms to the way in which the Senate is elected. That's half the parliament, to ensure it is voters, not talented preference whisperers who get to decide who goes to Canberra and ensures that our democracy is respected and not undermined. Now, this week, I've ensured that the Senate will reconvene on the 18th of April to make a decision on whether to pass another critical economic reform to re-establish the rule of law at construction sites where industrial disputation has imposed significant costs on construction in this country. And in the budget on the 3rd of May, we will include changes to the tax system that will be designed to generate jobs and growth and promote innovation and enterprise. Every level of our policy effort, every lever, every angle, every measure is directed at ensuring Australia makes that successful transition to a new and more diverse economy, to a stronger and more agile economy, one that is better able to seize the extraordinary opportunities that we are presented with today. Here we are in the fastest growing region in the world, a region in the world where more than half of the world's middle class will be residing before very long, a pace of transformation unknown, unprecedented in scale and pace in all of human history. 40 years ago, which seems an eon to most of this very youthful audience, 40 years ago, China was not engaged in the global economy at all, and today it is, depending on who is doing the measuring, either the world's largest single national economy or about to be the world's largest single national economy. These are extraordinary times. These are exciting times. And to succeed in seizing those opportunities, we have to be agile. We have to move faster. And every measure we are undertaking, every policy of my government, is calculated to ensure that we are better able to seize those opportunities. So we need to redouble our efforts to keep in step with the Chinese. The opportunities of the Chinese economy is just one of the big opportunities in our region. The China Free Trade Agreement is specifically designed to capture those huge export opportunities that will arise with the empowerment of Chinese consumers. Growth rates will be lower, undoubtedly, but from a much larger base. China is managing a difficult transition from an economy that was driven, fueled by investment, particularly in infrastructure and real estate development. And they're turning their economy around slowly so that it is being more driven, more fueled, as our economy is and as most developed, all developed economies are, by consumers, by consumption. Therein lies enormous opportunities. And right across the economy, for services, for soft commodities, every aspect of our Australian economy can benefit from that. But we have to be fast, we have to be smart, we have to be at the cutting edge. And as growth in China continues, but at a slower rate than we've had in the past, India is next in line to offer new and exciting opportunities. India is one of the greatest political achievements. It's been often described by Indian historians as an improbable democracy and an unlikely nation. Never before a nation in the form it became in 1949. India is diverse in every respect, all the world's great religions, 22 official languages in 11 different scripts. It succeeded in creating a political unity through a common commitment to the rule of law and a settled democratic parliamentary system. We wonder at the scale of the Chinese economic miracle, and so we should. But my friends, the Indian political miracle is just as remarkable and just as inspiring. The Indian economy by 2050 could be as large as that of the United States and still growing fast, according to our Treasury's projections. Its working age population is currently approaching the same size as China's, with 1 billion people aged between 15 and 64. But while China's working age cohort is likely to shrink by 20% by the middle of this century, at which point its demographic descent could be steeper than contemporary China, this is the point that John Howard has often made, that China faces the prospect of getting old before it becomes rich. I think it may become both, actually, at the rate they're going. But India's workforce will keep growing well into the second half of this century. India's investment needs, its voracious appetite for energy and the rapidly expanding demands of its burgeoning middle class add up to another historic opportunity that we must seize, as we have with China and Japan. Trade with India has not looked this promising for hundreds of years. I should note that for visitors from Victoria, that the foundation of Melbourne was in part financed by Indian bankers, so there is a long-standing tradition of Indian capital working in Australia. And that's why, to aid the transition to a new and more diversified economy, I'm placing a high priority on the conclusion of a free trade agreement with India, as complex as those talks have been. India demonstrates why there has never been a better time for a fresh look at the opportunities of our own region as our neighbours vault towards middle-class prosperity in this increasingly connected world. And there is no part of the regional transformation, however, that is more exciting to me than the one that is taking place right here on our doorstep. Now, they say that no two neighbours are more different than Australia and Indonesia. In fact, I think there are a few people in this room who've written those exact words. Well, if this was ever true, then it is no longer. Today, Indonesia is a vibrant democracy with a growing middle class, with as many mobile phones as people, and after the United States, the nation with the largest number of Facebook accounts. Our northern neighbour is already home to 250 million people, including 200 million of working age. Like India, this 15 to 64-year-old cohort will continue to grow for decades to come. India is on track to become the world's fifth largest economy around 2030, ranked behind four other Indo-Pacific countries: China, the United States, India and Japan. Now, we are doing everything we can to ensure our exporters are as well positioned to meet Indonesia's vast market opportunities. It is a personal foreign policy objective of mine to strengthen those ties with Indonesia. Lucy and I visited President Widodo and his wife Ibu Iryana last year, and we found we had much in common. We had a long discussion about planning and infrastructure. Both President Widodo and Lucy are former mayors, and they had plenty to talk about on urban issues. And my visit with the President was capped off with a Jokowi Blusukan, an impromptu visit to a market, in this case one with thousands of people really excited to meet their President. The President, I should say, who showed not the slightest discomfort, demonstrated his gallantry and empathy for me by joining me when I took off my coat and tie before I melted in the Jakarta heat. It was very decent of him. Since then, we have made good progress in providing certainty to our cattle trade with Indonesia, rudely interrupted, as you will recall, regrettably, by the Labor government. And last week, we took a further step in this direction with Indonesia's Trade Minister, Tom Lembong, recommencing negotiations with Trade and Investment Minister Stephen Chobo on a new comprehensive economic partnership agreement. It helps that 8 Indonesian cabinet ministers of the past 10 years have been educated in Australia. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop tells me she is more likely to communicate by text message with her Indonesian counterpart, Retno Marsudi, naturally and instantly, than with any other foreign minister around the world. In fact, they are together today, co-chairing the 40-nation Bali process and tackling the vexed cross-border questions of people smuggling and related transnational crime. And much of what I've said about Indonesia can be extended right across Southeast Asia, where our relationships are increasingly defined by similarities and complementarities rather than differences. Now, the greatest run of peace and prosperity our planet has ever known, centred right here in our Indo-Pacific region, was all made possible by the system of rules and institutions which the United States and its allies built from the ashes of World War II. This system has been anchored by the United States and its framework of alliances, including, of course, ANZUS. The challenge is that the tremendous growth in our region affects long-standing strategic balances. In the next 2 decades, half of the world's submarines and at least half of the world's advanced combat aircraft will be operating in our region. We simply have to do more and work harder to maintain our influence. And that is what our new Defence White Paper is all about. It is rigorous, it is fully costed. It is the blueprint that shows how we will develop our defence industries and continue to play our part in providing the measured balance upon which regional security depends. The White Paper states that our strategic defence objectives are not only to defend Australia from attack, but also include supporting the security of maritime Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. It enables us to continue to make substantial contributions to global efforts to maintain a stable Indo-Pacific region and the broader rules-based system. We believe it is imperative that differences between nations, whether land, air, sea, outer space, or cyberspace, are resolved in accordance with international law. In this context, we look forward in coming weeks to learning the outcome of the case brought by the Philippines under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Now, I have spoken elsewhere and at length about China, its history, its future, and what it means for us. So here, I will be brief. President Xi is right when he says China must seek to avoid the Thucydides trap, the conflict that is caused when an incumbent power is made anxious by the rise of a rival. However, it is undeniable that China's actions in the South China Sea are creating anxieties and raising tensions among its neighbours. They are, therefore, counterproductive, regardless of the legal merits on which, of course, we do not express a view nor make a claim. Disputes of the ownership of the various reefs of the South China Sea should be settled by international law, not by creating facts on the ground or, in this case, land in the water. The extraordinary economic growth of our region, especially China's, has depended on a long period of more than 40 years of relative tranquility. There is too much at stake to risk disturbing it. China in 2016 is part of a neighbourhood of strong and strengthening states that I've been describing, not to speak of the continuing and essential vital presence of the United States. In our Defence White Paper, we not only accept this emerging multipolar reality, we embrace it. The Defence White Paper is very clear-eyed about our circumstances. That is why we are not only doing everything we can to work even more closely with the United States, but we're also deepening our partnership with Japan and our practical defence cooperation with countries across the region. Japan remains the world's third largest national economy, with a population of 125 million and a commitment to and continuing to comply with the rules-based international order. That's why we are also working assiduously to build and strengthen defence cooperation with India, whose working age population, as I observed earlier, is projected to be 70% larger than any other nation at the end of the century. The foundation of our strategic cooperation with India is a shared commitment for international law and international norms, fundamental human rights, and the peaceful settlement of disputes. And it's why we're looking forward to working even more closely with ASEAN, our second largest trading partner, if taken as a bloc. As Barack Obama told ASEAN leaders when he invited them to Sunnylands last month, when ASEAN speaks with a clear, unified voice, it can help advance security, opportunity and human dignity, not only for the more than 600 million people across ASEAN, but for people across the Asia-Pacific and around the world. And we believe that a stable, increasingly prosperous and democratic Indonesia will be an important partner for us in promoting regional stability and ensuring that all members of our region play by the rules. The world has benefited mightily from China's rise, and no country more so than ours. We have a huge stake in the success of China's economic transition and the great opportunities it brings. The China-Australia Free Trade Agreement, one of the most ambitious of its kind and the highest quality free trade agreement China has entered into with any comparable nation, means that our farmers and our service professionals, tourism, higher education, healthcare providers, architects, lawyers, engineers have now been given an inside lane. And our new free trade agreements with Japan and Korea, and of course the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, are opening the door to new opportunities across our region. It would be remiss of me not to observe that these free trade agreements were negotiated and concluded by our Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, who has stepped down as Trade Minister because he is not running for re-election at in the seat of Goldstein at the election this year. Andrew's achievement has been remarkable. There has never been a Trade Minister in our history that has concluded, that has opened so many doors, and his contribution to our future prosperity is extraordinary. And if you wish, I would like to give him a round of applause. The new and more complex economic landscape emerging in China and across the rest of Asia will require more focus and hard work. The same is true for our strategic environment, which is becoming increasingly complex. In both the economic and security realms, we have to be agile and resilient, and above all, very clear-eyed. This is a time for a very keen focus on our national interest. The costs of standing still are unacceptable. The opportunities for those who seize them are immense. The attitude we're adopting here at home is one we're taking abroad. The great lesson from the post-war era is that prosperity and peace flows from open markets, diversity, progress, and the rule of law. The lesson from what we're seeing from Syria and Iraq or overnight in Brussels is that none of this can be taken for granted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, to move the formal vote of thanks to the Prime Minister, I'm pleased to call upon Andrew McKenzie. Andrew is the Chief Executive of BHP Billiton, one of tonight's sponsors and a long-standing Lowy Institute corporate member. He is the leader of the Big Australian and a believer in a larger Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew McKenzie.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's very much my pleasure to be here this evening to deliver a vote of thanks to the Prime Minister for his fine and thought-provoking lecture. Before I do that, I'd like to do a couple of things. First of all, listening to the Prime Minister advocating on behalf of Andrew Robb, I had the pleasure to work with Andrew during the G20 when it was here in Brisbane because I looked after the B20's contribution. And I could only underline the gratitude I feel to Andrew for what he has achieved. not just in seeing things in action then, but actually the practical expression of what he's done in securing sticky exports for this company and for Australia using these agreements since then. So thank you, Andrew. I think the second thing I wanted to say was actually to recognize that this event is, of course, somewhat overshadowed by what's happened yesterday in Belgium. I have, as I was saying to the ambassador, a slight association with that country. I spent a couple of years studying right next to the border in Aachen, and I used to spend most of my weekends either skiing, it was cross-country skiing, as you can imagine, or walking in the Ardennes, and a regular visitor to Brussels. So I was particularly saddened by the events and reminded, as we all are, that issues of security affect everything that we talk about, including, by the way, some of the discussions that we have within BHP Billiton. So let me extend my sympathies to the people of Belgium on behalf of BHP Billiton, and I think the industrialists here in this country. But let me say a little bit, maybe, to amplify on the poster that's behind me. You know, as one of the world's largest resources companies, headquartered here in Australia, and proud to be called Australian, we do find ourselves talking a lot, maybe a lot more than we should, but a lot lately, about the nation's future and how we can seize the opportunities in front of us to create a more prosperous future for us, but also for Australia. And unlike the Prime Minister, we are hugely ambitious for this country because we see a unique range of exciting possibilities for the country that we think is unparalleled in almost any other country in the world. And we want to work with Australia to seize these opportunities confidently. And it's very much one about long-term planning, because in our industry, I mean, particularly at the moment, we do understand there are cycles, but these cycles, which at times can get to you, but they don't, are also cycles of opportunity. They're driven by a range of forces, in our cases, predominantly market. So it does take this long-term perspective to plan and prosper them, perhaps even more so as we're doing at the moment for a little bit of a low point, although we've had a relief more recently. But we don't form these views on our own, heaven forbid. You know, we, as many others in Australia, draw on leaders in international policy and thought leadership. And preeminent in that are the Lowy Institute and people like Michael Fulilove and his team. And we need them to understand the broader global context and what it means for our future, and indeed the future for ourselves in Australia. And this institute, the Lowy Institute, provides tremendous leadership and expertise here. Their research, the collaboration, and forums like today's lectures are what help us at BHP Billiton, and no doubt many, many others in this room and elsewhere, understand the challenges that we face that in some days only seem to increase, but also, more importantly, how we can address them. So I congratulate the Institute on the event tonight and thank them for their continued role in shaping the nation's conversation, but also, I think, the nation's future, and a good future it is there. So one of the key topics that the Prime Minister has reflected on tonight is, of course, we all tend to, the next phase in the development boom in the Indo-Pacific. I mean, we think about it preeminently, I suppose, as our company, the rebalancing in China from being a high-intensity commodity consumer to one that is more based towards services and domestic consumption. But the Prime Minister did remind me of the opportunities that will be there for companies like us and this country as India too emerges. And although India is a country which is a bit more resource-rich than China, and will, they're not quite as good the resources they have in Australia, but they will want to exploit most of them, there are still a number of areas where they have a marked deficit, which Australia can actually match very well. So it's very important that we find a way for Australia to have the opportunity to benefit from China's transition and, if you like, the emergence of India as a powerful economic force. And we have to do this, as the Prime Minister said, through upskilling, improved productivity and innovation. And, you know, the mining industry is a pretty good leader at innovation, if I may say so. And therefore, I think we have a very important role in this transition, whether it's through the ongoing supply of the materials that help make many of the economic growth that is going to happen to the north of us a reality, or whether it's through our own innovative use of technologies. And if you want to see advanced manufacturing in Australia, increasingly you should go to a mining site, because that is driving a lot of the productivity that's been essential for us to continue to prosper at this point in the cycle. It's a day-to-day priority for us in BHP Billiton, and of course everybody else who competes with us. It's ingrained in how we operate and the way our employees approach their roles. So just to give you a few stats, if I might, over the last 4 years, we've actually made about $10 billion of cost reductions across our operating costs, $5 billion here in Australia. And that's been driven by almost 10,000 ideas from our employees at every level of the organization. So it's our own, if you like, our very own ideas boom, if you can call it that. And we welcome competition, and we welcome the competition from smaller companies, which the Prime Minister spoke of. So they're all playing catch-up or suggesting ideas that we compete, and it's so good for Australia, as I've said many times. But the efficiency that we've achieved in many ways, I think, is so appropriate for this country. I think it's appropriate for everything that we want to do. You know, I mean, I think it is in some ways remarkable that you look across this industry here, this mining industry, and yes, it's maybe grown a bit fat, but roughly speaking, it's taken about a third to half of its costs out, you know, and continuing to produce more, you know, in the space of 3 or 4 years. I wonder if we could do that. I had to say this with government expenditure. But anyway, let me move on, because there are many other things that government can do to promote innovation in our sector. And we've heard a bit about R&D and education. Got it in our poster there. And I'd have to put in a plug. Frank was acknowledged for that, for infrastructure. But when the Prime Minister spoke about opportunity, I couldn't also reflect on the partnership and the parallel path to prosperity that exists between this company and this nation. We actually have quite a humble history. We started out as on a dusty outback camp in Broken Hill, and through hard work, seeking out international expertise and the application of innovation, we've actually become a national and then an international force. And just to talk a bit about multiculturalism, the top 20 people in BHP Billiton come from 10 companies. Almost all of us speak at least two languages, and 40% of them are women. So we really do embrace this. And the majority of us live and work in Australia. So that, I think, is a very powerful advert of what we can achieve. I think there are very few companies of our scale who could boast that kind of multiculturalism in the leadership of their operations, and I think it gives us a competitive edge. But similar things have happened in this country. Australia has grown from a collection of colonial economies to a national economy, and now a major player in the global economy, and one of China's and hopefully soon India's top trading partners. I think it has a great future. You know, I look forward very much to being part of that future, a more diverse future, as the Prime Minister said, as we move away, but not entirely, from the importance of resources to our economy. So, Prime Minister, I share your optimism and belief in Australia's future. With strong leadership and confidence in our abilities, and a willingness to embrace change and innovation, this next century belongs as much to Australia as it belongs to any nation. And I, Michael, do feel that my watchtower of history tells me that. So on behalf of everybody here tonight, Prime Minister, I thank you for your time and for your inspiring address. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the formalities for the 2016 Lowy Lecture. Let me echo Andrew Mackenzie's thanks to the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, for delivering an important, wide-ranging lecture that will be studied closely here and abroad in the coming months, starting on the Interpreter blog first thing tomorrow morning. He had very interesting things to say on Indonesia, on India, on China, on Asia, on the global order. Of course, the speech was marked by Malcolm's trademark optimism. Malcolm, you're well known for believing that there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian. And when you were talking about this week's parliamentary dramatics, the Senate reform and the proroguing of Parliament, it did occur to me there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian Prime Minister either. But thank you very much, Prime Minister, for taking the time to set out an intellectual framework for us to think about the world. Let me acknowledge in particular our corporate sponsors for tonight's event, Capital Group, BHP Billiton and Qantas, who are represented this evening by Paul Hennessy, Andrew McKenzie and Andrew Parker. Please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in thanking them for supporting this year's Lowy Lecture. I'd like to thank and acknowledge all of our corporate and government members who are listed in your program. They are a vital source of support for the Institute's work. Finally, let me thank my outstanding colleagues at the Institute. The planning for this kind of event usually takes a long time. In this case, we've done it in several months, and I think they've done an exceptional job. Everybody at the Institute has contributed to the evening's success, but let me mention in particular Tara Pienaar, the whirling dervish at the centre of the night, along with Sarah, Sue Yin, Louisa, Andrea, Anthony, Steph, Chris, John, Barbara and Dave for all their hard work. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for joining us. As some of you know, we have moved recently from our old home at 31 Bligh Street to new digs at Level 3, 1 Bligh Street. This is actually the same building that houses the Prime Minister's Sydney office, so you're always welcome to drop in for a cup of tea, Malcolm. And ladies and gentlemen, we also look forward to seeing all of you at our new headquarters at No. 1 Bligh Street very soon. Thank you for joining us for the 2016 Lowy Lecture.